Hi, Julian.
Hi, Austin.
We are here at Georgetown today for another episode of The Fly. We are very excited about today's episode, even though the weather is a little bit rainy outside, but it doesn't matter, because today we have not one, but two guests in our interview. This is a very special edition episode. We did two mini interviews with both of our guests who were here at Georgetown for a panel on the role of youth voters in the 2024 election cycle.
Our first interview is with Waleed Shaheed, Senior Democratic Strategist and former spokesperson for Justice Democrats. And our second interview is with Allegra Kirkland, Politics Director at Teen Vogue magazine.
We had an amazing discussion with both Shaheed and Kirkland about youth voter mobilization and the future of their parties, as well as the impact of social media on polarization today. We hope you enjoyed this special edition episode and the double interview today. That you watched your parents register to vote for the first time. Could you talk a little bit about how you first got involved in politics, some social dynamics you witnessed that you think later influenced your career, and just kind of any formative experiences you had with politics growing up?
Yeah. So thanks for having me. I grew up across the Potomac River in Arlington, Virginia. And on September 11th, my family experienced police harassment and discrimination when I was about 10 years old, so I was in fifth grade, and the climate in Northern Virginia after September 11th was very scary for Muslims. There's a thing called the Patriot Act, which made it very easy for Muslim Americans to get caught up in the criminal justice system and through FBI surveillance. There was lots of rumors going around that, I mean, there wasn't rumors, this was reported in the Washington Post and other outlets at the time, but the FBI would come to mosques in Northern Virginia and try to engage people in entrapment, which is basically they would ask people what they thought of the president and the war, and then they would try to use that to determine if somebody was a quote-unquote extremist. But, you know, the definition of that was very loose at the time. And so in that environment, my parents told me to never talk about politics in school. But I was like any kid growing up. As I became like a preteen, 12, 13, 14 years old, I really liked Blink-182, and I became a punk rocker and decided to, one of my acts of rebellions was to really get into reading the Washington Post. Mm-hmm. And on Fridays in my social studies class, we used to have current events day, and we would all read a newspaper article together from the Washington Post. And I was in sixth grade around 2002, 2003, and so most of the articles we would read would be about Saddam Hussein and the Iraq War. And my teacher, my social studies teacher, was very pro-war and believed Saddam Hussein was in part behind the attacks of September 11th. And I would go home and prepare and like go on the internet and read a lot of articles, and felt like it was interesting. And you know, I was kind of a little bit of a punk rock kid and wanted to be rebellious, and I would debate with her in class. Turns out I was right and she was wrong about Saddam Hussein and weapons of mass destruction. But in high school, I went to Washington Lee High School in Arlington, which is now called Washington Liberty. And was really involved in immigrant rights activism in my freshman year of high school in 2006. I was part of this national wave of students who walked out of their high schools in protest of draconian immigration laws, and just was really active in the kind of activist scene in Northern Virginia, Washington, D.C. around immigrant rights and also anti-war stuff. And then in college, I wasn't very active. I was like a arts kid. I studied religion and like literature and history. I was a nerd. I thought I was going to be a medieval studies professor. I studied abroad in London, and I took like three classes on medieval studies and found it incredibly boring and out of touch. And ended up moving to Philadelphia after graduating college and getting involved in community organizing and activism there. And then worked for a labor union, worked for Bernie, I worked for AOC and Justice Democrats. It kind of all went from there.
And could you describe how you initially got involved with Justice Democrats? And maybe for viewers or listeners who are unfamiliar, just explain a little bit about the organization and what its mission is.
Sure. So Justice Democrats was founded by staffers from the Bernie Sanders campaign in 2016. And they what they wanted to do was continue what Bernie Sanders called the political revolution by recruiting people who ran on Bernie Sanders' platform for Congress, who looked like their communities. A lot of the theory of the organization was that Bernie Sanders won 43% of the Democratic primary, but 43% of members of Congress in the Democratic Party did not represent Bernie's views, especially on things like climate change, healthcare, money in politics, Wall Street reforms, these kinds of things. And we also wanted to use the primary system, the Democratic primary system, to bring about generational and political change, and highlight the kind of difference that Bernie highlighted in 2016 and the party that is primarily on generational lines. And so the most successful campaign that everybody knows about now is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's campaign. We also felt like it was important to, you know, lots of people know this, but 50% of Congress is made up of millionaires. We wanted to recruit people who came from more humble backgrounds that represented, you know, the other 50% of Americans who aren't millionaires, who are have working class jobs. So we primarily tried to focus on recruiting people who were service workers, bartenders, nurses, principals, activists, people who weren't corporate lawyers or, you know, worked at the CIA or State Department, people who represented the everyday experience of working class Americans. And, you know, that has, I think the organization's mission has largely been successful, but to bring about like a shift in the Democratic Party, the biggest one is probably corporate money in the Democratic Party. That was one of our biggest things when we launched. And now many, many candidates who aren't not just progressives or people from the left, like many, even moderate candidates, reject corporate money. And I think that has been a good sign. We started the campaign for the Green New Deal with the Sunrise Movement. I think a lot of that activism and organizing led to the Inflation Reduction Act by President Biden, which was the most significant piece of climate legislation in world history. And, you know, I think that crew that's called the Squad, I think that represents the future of the Democratic Party. And as millennials and Gen Z continue to vote and run for office, I think most of the party, a lot of the party will begin to look a lot more like people like AOC than like Joe Biden.
Yeah, definitely. How do you see social movements and electoral work interacting in modern politics? What do you think the relationship is between the two?
I think they can feed off each other, and I think sometimes they can be in conflict with each other. So a social movement is primarily focused on changing public opinion and drawing attention to a problem that isn't getting the public's attention. And politicians, it's their job to take that shift and take that energy and take that shift and channel it into formal political channels. And so, you know, there's a whole history of this in the United States, from the abolitionist movement to women's suffrage to the labor movement, civil rights, LGBT rights, and the anti-war movement, et cetera, et cetera. And so I think, like, if you look at the Democratic Party today, it is a series of what used to be social movements that are now called interest groups. And so the Democratic Party is primarily made up of these, like the feminist movement, the reproductive rights movement, the LGBT movement, the climate movement, racial justice movement, migrant rights movement. That kind of makes up what the Democratic Party is. And, you know, if you look at any of those movements, when they started, they were unpopular when they started. They were fringe, they were activists, they were left-wing, and, like, slowly they've gained entrance in the Democratic Party. And I think today there are still movements that are still trying to get into the front door of the Democratic Party and maybe represent a minority of elected officials, but increasingly represent a majority of public opinion, or at least public opinion amongst Democrats and young people. And I think, so, you know, it's always a push and pull. Like, it's up when a politician sometimes will side with an unpopular movement because it's the right thing to do. Sometimes they'll wait for that movement to, you know, grow in popularity until they take that stand. Joe Biden is the king of, you know, putting his finger in the air and deciding when it's time to join a movement. Famously on gay marriage, he came out before Barack Obama did by accident on that. But I think it's up to, there's always that kind of history of movements and elected officials pushing and pulling the party to move in the direction of progress.
And in your capacity with Justice Democrats, you've been involved a lot with the Squad and other progressive politicians. Mm-hmm. What do you think their future looks like? What do you think the future of the party looks like, realignment-wise? Mm-hmm. And how do you see the ongoing conflict between Israel and Palestine playing into their electability?
Cool. I'll take the first part first. Yeah, I think a lot of these members of the squad, you know, they represent, fundamentally they represent generational change in the United States and generational change in the Democratic Party. This is the bench of the Democratic Party in a lot of ways, and so I can imagine many of these people either stay in the House of Representatives and continue to build their like quasi-caucus and build their influence in the Progressive Caucus, build their influence on committees. Ilhan Omar is on the was on the Foreign Affairs Committee. AOC is on the Oversight Committee. Pramila Jayapal is on the Judiciary Committee, where they have influence. On the other hand, you know, some of them might run for Senate or statewide office at some point, but primarily their role is to like rally the media and social movements around causes that the Democratic Party is ignoring or too afraid to take up because it's not politically palatable to the party as a whole. But if they speak out, then slowly other people speak out, and it kind of bubbles from there. When it comes to Israel-Palestine and the war in Gaza, look, like, often the number one spender against the squad in these races is the AIPAC lobby. For people who don't know, AIPAC is the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, or Council, I forget what the C stands for. They have a super PAC that raises lots of money from Republican donors to spend against people who they deem out of touch with quote-unquote pro-Israel policies. There's a series of primary elections coming up. Jamal Bowman, Summer Lee, Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib, and Cori Bush, in which AIPAC has is spending money against them or has recruited a challenger against them. To me, it's completely inappropriate to have Republican money in a Democratic primary, but a large part of AIPAC's money does come from Republican donors. This is a significant like challenge for the squad because there is not an organized pro-Palestinian lobby in the way that there is, either financially or politically, like there is a pro-Israel lobby. And so you could easily see one or two members of the squad having really competitive races going into June, going into August, and it will be one of those things where a lot of the times AIPAC doesn't have, their TV ads aren't about Israel, their TV ads are about, you know, they poll what the worst message is you can say about AOC, and then they amplify that because they know most voters don't actually care that much about Israel or Palestine, and so it will become a referendum on the state, what AIPAC wants to do is send a message to every young progressive Democrat that you can't be a member of Congress in the Democratic Party unless you stand with AIPAC. That is the challenge, I think, and I think there's been a lot of infrastructure developing on the kind of pro-Palestinian side or anti-war side, but it's young and nowhere near the financial might of AIPAC.
Yeah, I think that's all really interesting to see how it all interacts. You've been really involved with the Uncommitted Movement in the Democratic parties. What effect do you see Biden's stance on Israel having in the general election? Will this change due to the U.S. not voting for the ceasefire resolution? How do you think that all plays in, and how do you see the future of Biden Netanyahu's relationship?
Yeah, somehow things are changing day by day, week by week, and somehow things are staying exactly the same. And so I think, like, in the Muslim and Arab community, many people I know are planning to not vote for Joe Biden in the November elections. I don't think that any of them are voting for Donald Trump, but they might vote third party or stay at home. I don't agree with that point of view, but part of the Uncommitted campaign is people who are Democrats and are Democratic strategists and pundits and people who are involved in the party want to communicate to President Biden that this is a serious movement in the country of Muslims, of Arabs, of young people who are really upset at the president's financial backing of Israel's war in Gaza, Netanyahu's war in Gaza, and we felt like President Biden wasn't taking that very seriously. And so even if many of us might still vote for Biden in November, we know that there are way more people in our community who probably won't because they think it's morally reprehensible to support this war. And so the Uncommitted Movement was a way to show to essentially warn President Biden of what he was losing votes in Michigan. In some ways, it's been successful, and in other ways, you know, things have remained the same. I think the Uncommitted campaign has, like, moved a lot of Democrats toward understanding how deep the pain is and anger is amongst many young people and Arabs and Muslims, particularly in states like Michigan. That's a key swing state going into November. On the other hand, President Biden's position hasn't changed that much. He has mostly changed his messaging and rhetoric. He's become meaner about Prime Minister Netanyahu. He has become more and more concerned about civilian casualties, but has still sent weapons and diplomatic support for the war. Just this week we had the World Central Kitchen had three of their trucks hit by IDF strikes. I think this might be a big moment for the administration to, one, understand what exactly happened and how those aid workers were killed, but two, why they're sending weapons to a military that is killing aid workers. So who knows in the next couple days what happens, but I am very, very scared about the potential of President Biden handing over the election and our democracy to Donald Trump simply because he has an alliance with Prime Minister Netanyahu, and I pray that he changes course before the November elections.
I think that is all the time we have, but thank you so much for being here. This is absolutely fantastic. Thank you again for your time.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much to Waleed Jaheed for taking the time to speak with us today and for his amazing discussion. Now we're going to move on to the second part of our episode and our second interview of the day with Allegra Kirkland, the politics director for Teen Vogue. Let's get right to it. Constantly shifting political environment, how do you discern which issues young people care the most about?
Well, we've had certain beats we've just been paying attention to for a long time. You know, from voting rights to
Okay. We have so many edits.
Okay. We were just talking about voting rights. From gun violence to climate organizing to immigration. So really just that social justice organizing is kind of an umbrella has just been like core to the Teen Vogue politics team since its inception, which was around 2016. I mean, I feel like that gives us so much leeway underneath like social justice to cover so many specific movements. And then we also do a lot of history coverage, surprisingly, but sort of just to contextualize some of that work. You know, just that, you know, young people didn't just start organizing in a vacuum. This work has been happening for decades, and a lot of it is kind of poorly taught in American schools or not taught at all. So we do a lot of coverage around that as well.
And as someone immersed in the world of young people in politics, what do you notice about young voters' attitudes towards the upcoming election? And what do you think may distinguish this from past elections?
Sure. So we're going to get into this at my panel tonight. But this is a tough one, at least when it comes to the presidential. I think all the polling has shown not a lot of enthusiasm across the board for the Biden-Trump rematch, but particularly among young people. I think they're not very hyped about these two choices. So I think where we're putting a lot of our energy at Teen Vogue is, you know, what issues are animating young people? Like what are they pushing, you know, Biden on, for example? Like what local races are they paying attention to? Like there's a lot of organizing around state measures and amendments for protecting reproductive rights in states like Florida. So there is a lot of, you know, exciting work happening, and young people, I think, are really motivated around those issues, even though I think apathy is kind of the word I keep hearing around the presidential race, so.
Some polling has shown that young voters care more about economic issues for this election. To what extent do you think economic concerns are shaping young voters' outlook, and what are those economic concerns, would you think?
Sure. I mean, I think one major issue is student debt. We actually have a whole package running on student debt in May, but payments are resuming for a lot of people after the COVID moratorium, and it's, you know, combined with high rents in a lot of cities where young people are living, it's a huge impact on, you know, where people can choose to live and what jobs they can afford to take, and can, you know, one of the pieces running in the package is on people deferring mental health care because they can't afford to go to their therapist and also pay their bills. So I think those are definitely front of mind economic concerns for young people.
Yeah, so shifting topics just a little bit, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit how your experience at Teen Vogue has been so far. What Teen Vogue is not primarily a political magazine. What do you find is some of the most interesting aspects of working in politics for a non-political magazine?
Sure, yeah. So you know, the kind of shift to Teen Vogue covering politics heavily actually predates my time there. It dates back to, as I said, the kind of 2016 era when I think there was this explosion of youth organizing, I think partially in response to the Trump election. So it's been there for a while. We've been doing this work for a while. And I think the nice thing about it is we don't see it as like siloed at Teen Vogue. Like, I think there's an understanding among editors and, you know, going up to editor-in-chief and executive editor that politics it affects everything. It affects, you know, the clothes you buy. It affects, it's in the music you listen to. Artists are talking about these issues, like, at the Oscars, on stage, at shows. Like, everything is political. So there's a lot of collaboration across sections in what we, you know, choose to cover. I was talking to some of the students earlier about, you know, for our midterms cover in 2022, we actually had Phoebe Bridgers talking about repro rights and Roe getting overturned. So I appreciate that there's a lot of just like overlap and collaboration and not just seeing politics as like, oh, this like boring thing off in the corner.
And what would you say your day-to-day looks like at Teen Vogue?
The really unsexy answer is answering emails. I answer so many emails. That is my job. Because we don't have staff writers. All of our writers are freelancers. So that's why it's just so much, you know, being in touch on different stories, you know, catching them up on, like, here's the fact check and let's address these notes or legal, let's do the legal review. And also being on the phone a lot for that reason too. And a lot of meetings. But yeah, I kind of try to have the first half of my week be more that like day-to-day kind of work and figuring out, you know, what coverage looks like for that week. And then I save the end of my week, my Friday, for like, what are packages we want to do? What are bigger series, bigger swings, profiles, kind of that like longer term brainstorming.
Yeah, well, I think that is all the time we have, but thank you so much. This is absolutely fantastic. And thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for listening to The Fly. You can find us on social media at The Fly Georgetown. If you enjoyed our conversation, make sure to subscribe to The Fly and leave a 5-star rating on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or SoundCloud. Our researchers are Kenneth Jackson, Julian Zeitlinger, Abigail Asadi, and Chase Dobson. Our communications team is Andrea Smith, Austin Culpepper, Darius Wagner, and Sarah Sverdlov. Our production team is Will Hayes and David Grice. Original theme music is composed by Aiden Ng and Bella Carlucci. And I'm Fiona Gallagher, Managing Director of the Pod. The Fly is brought to you by the Georgetown University Institute of Politics and Public Service, and is made possible by the McCourt School of Public Policy. Thanks so much for listening, and fly with you soon.